I can see this is like a reunion where legislators and friends get together and want to chat with each other, but I think most of the committee chairs are here. I'd like to welcome you all here. I'm Senator Sandy Pappas, Chair of the Higher Ed Committee in the Senate. I'm here with Representative Tom Rukavina, who chairs the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee in the House. We invited the other education chairs to join us this morning. Some are at the table. If there isn't room at the table for legislators, please, you know, feel free to join us in the audience. But we still do have room up here at the table if any legislators would like to join us at the table. We're very happy to have Speaker Margaret Kelleher Anderson here this morning, and she's going to welcome us and greet our visitors and introduce Gaston Caperton, who's president of the College Board.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman. I'm so pleased to join the Higher Education Joint Committee this morning. It's not a place that I have been able to come often, and it's great to see all the members. It's sort of like, you know, going back to school, isn't it, in these weeks when we gather all together after many months apart. So thank you for being here, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your invitation to Governor Caperton so that he can come and share with you some of the things the College Board is working on attracting and retaining first-generation college students, people that we really want to have engaged in our higher education systems, and making sure, sharing those ideas for affordability as well as access. We think that is very important, and I'm so pleased to join you to bring some emphasis to that this morning. So I'd like to have you all join me in welcoming Gaston Caperton, who is the president of the College Board. Many of you also know that he's a former governor of West Virginia. He's a nationally known speaker and teacher and expert on current affairs and reshaping the American education system to make sure that the American dream is a reality for all of our students, regardless of their background. As the state's 31st governor from 1988 to 1996, Governor Caperton brought West Virginia back from the brink of bankruptcy. It had more than $500 million in debt and transformed that state, and they could boast a $100 million surplus when he was done and investing in the state school building program. He also developed a comprehensive plan that emphasized the use of computers and technology in public schools and raised teacher salaries to the 31st level in the nation from the 49th. That's no small task while dealing with a budget deficit. After he left his public service in the State House, he served as a fellow at the John F. Kennedy Institute of Politics, something near and dear to Madam Chairwoman's heart and mine. We both have studied there. And he also taught at Columbia University. He started his career as a businessman. He started his career in the insurance industry. And as he did that, he grew his insurance brokerage to the 10th largest in the country. So this man comes to us with experience both in the private sector and a deep love of the public sector. And I think that's very important. He's received many, many national awards, 8 honorary doctorate degrees, as well as he led the National Governors Association and served on the National Governors Association Executive Committee. Mr. Caperton now is serving as the 8th president of the College Board, which is heading up an innovative program that you're going to hear a lot more about today. And that is the College Keys Compact. It targets students who we need to engage in higher education. It's a national effort. It helps engage, it helps the students that we're targeting overcome financial difficulties, barriers caused by inadequate preparation, which I know your committees have spent some time on, and their own low expectations, the lack of ongoing support, and providing more reliable information an insight into the value of college education, which I know the members of the House and Senate know well, how important it is to have a higher education. The College Board has developed a set of guidelines to accomplish their goal and is calling on its 5,200 institutional members, such as MNCU and the St. Paul School District, to implement the practices. Again, I'm going to stay with you for a little bit this morning to hear Governor Caperton. I just want all of us to extend a warm welcome to him this morning for joining us. Thank you, Governor.
Madam Speaker and Senator Pappas, thank you very much for this warm welcome to your very special state, and I want to thank you. You might tell a little bit from my accent that I appreciate your warming it up 15 degrees when I came here, but I did recognize that it was a little different temperature outside, and it's certainly nice and warm inside, and I appreciate your hospitality. I first want to thank you and the legislature for your strong support of education and some of the work that you're now supporting of the College Board. Let me, the speaker was very kind in her introduction. I'll tell you just on a little lighter side how I got to the College Board. I had been teaching at Columbia for about a year and a half when I got a call one day from a headhunter and asked, would I like to be interviewed for president of the College Board? And my answer was, my two sons have taken that test and I've taken that test. Why would I want to run a testing company? Now that tells you a little bit what I knew about the College Board and what most people know about the College Board. But I'll go just one step further. I went for my second interview to decide whether they'd give me that job or not. And you know, when you're in that kind of thing, there's some way in our lives that thoughts are out here, and all of a sudden they come into your head at the most unexpected time. And the thought that came into my head when I was interviewing was, do you think they're going to look at my SAT score? Now, with me, that's a pretty scary thought, because I'm dyslexic. And if you're dyslexic, you don't do real well on those kinds of tests. So fortunately, I don't think they did look at my SAT score, so I did get this job about 9 years ago. And what we've really worked hard at the College Board is to make the college month not a gate to college, but a gateway to college. That we were not just about testing students about getting into college, but our job was to prepare students to get into college and prepare students to get into college and succeed in college. The tragic figure that I know all of you know here in this room, but I'm always surprised at, is that about 40% of ninth graders go to college in about four-year college, and about half of those graduate. That's certainly not a figure that's going to keep this country in the world we live in at the place that it could be. So, the mission of the College Board is to connect students to college success with a focus on equity and excellence. Now, it's pretty easy to approach education only if you're worrying about excellence or you're only worrying about equity. But the combination of those two things is the real center point of what I believe education is about in this country. And one of the things that we have found and we believe and we know at the College Board is the huge number of students out there that have the capacity to do high-level work, succeed in that work, go to college, and be successful. And that's what I'd like to talk to you a little bit about today. First of all, why do I have this passion for education? I mentioned earlier that I'm dyslexic. In the fourth grade, my parents got a call from my teacher saying that I couldn't read. Now, this came as a great shock to my parents because I have a sister that's 5 years older than me that never made anything but A's and was Phi Beta Kappa in college in economics. So my father took me to see a doctor. He thought maybe something was wrong with my eyes. And this doctor told him that I had reversal, which today you call it dyslexia. My daddy was my first teacher. He made me every day before I went to school learn the words in the dictionary, how to spell words, how to pronounce words, and to know what they meant. And that's the hard way I kind of learned to read, because in those days there weren't many teachers of learning disabled children. So I know, and I know how important it was for me to be able to learn when I wasn't expected by my teachers early in those years to learn. And I was fortunate to have teachers along the way that inspired me and allowed me to get the education I did to have a successful and all those things that a college education, the opportunities that a college education offers people. So we at the College Board are deeply committed to getting more and more students ready for college. Now, many people, when the Advanced Placement Program was begun, it was really begun by those teachers, those best of teachers, who felt that they could teach kids college-level work in high school. And so those teachers went out into the community, into their school communities, and they kind of picked this kid and this kid and this kid. And they usually picked them maybe because their parents were active in the school, or the kid was just a good kid, or done real well. And they sort of thought the AP program was one that was just for what we would call kind of the special kids in a school. Well, we've learned over the years that there's a lot of special kids in these schools that are often overlooked. And so we have really democratized the AP program. We've made it so that more and more students can participate and be a part of this program. Now, you have in front of you, which I'd like to review with you, is this little brochure we did on Minnesota. And if you'll turn to the second page, let me put on my glasses. I'd like you to look at the first chart, and I'm showing you some comparisons of your state with neighboring states, also the nation, and Florida. And I'd like to go through these figures with you. We'll go from the left to the right. The percentage of students who took AP in high school, these are 2007 figures, and you can see Minnesota had 15.6%. Of those, 9.8% got a 3 or better on that examination. Now, why is the 3 or better important? Because almost every college in the country gives a kid college credit for an AP course, of which there's 32. Towards a college degree. The percentage of students in the next row, the percentage of students who took an AP exam in high school was 21%. The number of students who scored 3 or 5 on the AP exam is 13.4%. Now you can see that the first two figures are from 2001 and then 2007 are the second figures, and you can see the real progress that you have made here in Minnesota. But you haven't quite caught up with the nation, and you're thought of as an education state that should be ahead of national figures. You can see some of your neighbors in Wisconsin and Illinois. And you could see the great progress that you've made, but you've still got a lot of work to do. Now, one of the ways we've been able to democratize this AP program is to give students a PSAT in the 10th grade. Now, you might ask, what's that about? Well, we can now, in a scientific way, look at students and see who has the capacity and capability to take an AP course. And you can see what the potential is. We have used the PSAT as an example here in Minnesota, and you can see on the, and we show different kinds of courses. But you take U.S. U.S. government and politics, you have a little over 1,000 students in that. You have a potential of students who did well enough on the PSAT that you have a capacity of some 14,000. If you look down at physics, you can see that you have 482 students and you have a capacity of 2,800 students. So that gives you some sense of what the possibilities are. That there are those kinds of students that are out there that have the capacity, if they're prepared, to go into AP courses. Now, if you will look over on the next page, you'll see some other figures, and I think this is a very important thing. Since students participating in AP graduate at higher rates from college, and it goes down through here and shows that African-American students who have taken AP courses graduate 21% higher than those that haven't. Hispanics, 27%, white, 19%, low income, 32%, and not so low income at 23%. Now, these are facts and figures that give you some concept of what AP can be in working in your state, the potential that this kind of program has. Now, when I came to the College Board, one of the things that we found is that we had this AP program, but what did students do before they took AP? Were they really getting prepared to take that kind of course? You can't take an AP physics course or an AP calculus course if you haven't had a good Algebra 2 course. So we've now created a 6 through 12 program, which we call Springboard, which is based upon the AAP standards, I mean the AAU standards, which is our research university standards, of what a student needs to know to go to college. And we built a program based upon those standards. And it's what I call a pre-AP program. And then we have a program called that we give to kids called College Ed, which gets low-income kids understanding about what it is and how to go to college and how it's available to them. So we now have a program that we call a college success system of about 5 programs that people can put in a school that helps them fully prepare to be successful in high school with the capstone courses being AP programs. Now, let me show you, I want to show you in Florida, and I know no state likes to be compared to another state. I was the governor of a small state, and I didn't like people to compare me with other states, but it also inspired me. It made me see what the potential was, what we could do that we didn't know we could do. About 7 years ago, Governor Bush in Florida decided he wanted to put in this program that I've just talked to you about. And I had just come to the College Board for about a year when we decided to work with him on that. And I went down to see him. It was the first time I'd met him. And I said to him, Governor, I want to tell you that if you think we can do this in 1 year, you just are wasting your money and you're wasting your time. This has to be a long-term commitment. And he made that commitment. And the legislature down there made it. On a bipartisan basis, made that commitment. And let me just give you a few figures on what Florida has done. You'll look back on that chart that I showed you. You'll see that Florida now has 24%, almost 25% of their students participating in the AP program, of which 15% are passing with the 2, 3, or 4. That was what they were in 2001. Now they've gone up to 38% with 20% of those programs, those students getting 3, 4, or 5. That's really quite remarkable progress. Among Hispanic students, they've tripled the number of Hispanic students. And among African American students, they've doubled the number. So we are getting everybody to participate in these programs and being successful. So I think I show you these figures and facts to tell you a little bit about what I think to first of all congratulate you on the progress that you've made, but also to talk to you about the real potential there is with this kind of program. It's a national program. You don't have to worry about whether it's the standards are national standards, which I think is critically important to know really how you're doing. Now, I've also given each of you all what we call the College Keys Compact. This was a study, a two-year study that was done. The College Board is a membership organization of 5,200 schools and colleges. This is a program that was done to really analyze what had to be done to get low-income students prepared to go to college, into college, and successful out of college. And it asked the college, the membership of our organization, to make a commitment to this program. This is a pretty long thing. I'm not going to go through this. But you could read it. I think you'll see that we're on the right track in trying to help low-income students become part of this success, and also ways that it can be done, and I hope that you'll find it helpful and enlightening. Madam Chairman, I'm ready to answer any questions. That's a kind of a quick run through.
Thank you so much, Mr. Caperton. And before we take questions, I just wanted to thank all the committee chairs who agreed to come to this meeting today. I think it's kind of a first to have all the education chairs. Certainly, Representative Tommy Rukavina, who he and I have worked very closely this last year together. Representative Mindy Greiling, thank you for coming. Representative Carlos Mariani, my colleagues in the Senate, Senator Chuck Wieger, and Senator Leroy Stump, thank you for joining us, and thank you to all the members. Maybe rather than go around and do introductions, maybe you could just introduce yourself when you ask your question. I just wanted to say that I also wanted to thank the College Board staff, Fisher Renna, and others for making this happen. I think this is a really important issue, the whole idea of how we get low-income kids prepared for college and successful in college, and that's really our focus here today. I have been interested in this issue, but I didn't know that there was actually research to show that there are programs that are successful around the country, and I was privileged to be invited by the College Board last fall to attend their fall conference, in which there were numerous. I heard about the College Keys. I listened to Gaston speak and others, and I found out that they had actually done a lot of research, and they found some very successful programs. So, and we'll be hearing from one called Avid later today, and it's not going to break the bank. These are actually things that we can afford to do now. So, questions, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Dean Erdahl, and Governor, about one-third of the students who go to Minnesota colleges as freshmen are provided remedial services by the colleges. I was wondering how that compared with the national average, if you have any figures on that.
I do not have any figures, but I don't think that's unusual. I think it's something that shouldn't be in your state or in any state. And it's certainly a problem that needs to be addressed. But I don't have any facts or figures with me. I'm sorry. Do you to either of my colleagues?
Actually, that number is very consistent with what we find nationally. I'm Trisha Runner with the College Board. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. But yes, sir, that is consistent with what we find nationally. I know in Ohio, for example, that number is actually 40% of students entering four-year colleges in Ohio need remediation in either math or English. So those numbers are fairly consistent. Our goal with the college readiness system, the College Keeps Compact, is to do a better job of preparing students so that we can reduce and or perhaps even eliminate the need for remediation as students move into a two- or four-year institution. That's really our goal with the College Board, to do a better job of preparing students.
So the idea is they're taking more rigorous courses, basically, in high school that will prepare them.
That's correct.
That is
and starting in middle school to really put these students on the right track so that they are aware that things like a fourth year of high school math aren't an option, that we do need to move students through at least Algebra 2 or even into pre-calculus, calculus while they're still in high school so that they have the prerequisite skills to avoid remediation while in college.
Representative Cavina.
Could we have one of our staff move the projector. I'm short. I can't see over anybody. So,
Representative Rukavina, so am I.
I know. There. Thank you. I think more. Sorry.
Representative Morrill?
Yeah.
Representative Morrill had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming. One thing that we've noticed in outer or greater Minnesota is that AP courses are often offered in the fall. That's the only time they're offered, but the test is in the spring. I know I'm dealing with that in my own home. My daughter's saying, I don't want to take the test because I didn't take the course within the last 6 months. Has AP been talking about either two-time-a-year test offering or other ways to address this? Because especially in the rural part of the state, we can't afford to offer physics every semester or other courses that lead up to the test.
Mr. Caperton.
You're not the first person to ask us that question. But it really, to date, we just really can't figure out how to do it with any economy, because we do them, we really, most all these courses are given on an annualized basis, and it makes sense to give the course at the end of the year. And there are some people that are taking courses at a different time. The cost to have a whole new set of examinations. You couldn't give the same exam both times, and it just makes it really practically impossible to do it right now.
I share that concern. I just want to share with you the concern on this end is we can't offer the courses every semester or every term that lead up to the test. So I hope we'll continue to work together. We'll work on our funding side to try to figure out a way to fund those courses so they lead right up to test dates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure how, I guess, that is on. More of a point of clarification, I guess, than a question. Here in Minnesota, we have a number of different programs, and I'm sure other states do the same. Besides the AP, we have, like, college in the school, and we have IP, and we have the PSEO. So there's a number of options that students have, and I think it all works out fairly well, because in some cases one program works good because of the geographic area, such as PSEO. In another case, you maybe have college and schools. In another case, the AP works because you've had a tradition or teachers that are trained. So the numbers that you have here for Minnesota just reflect the AP numbers, not the total, because I think in the PSEO program, I think it's running around 10,000 students in Minnesota alone, not counting the college and the high school. Do all of the programs that encourage the minorities or the those that go on to college, I think, are excellent. The question that I have is, do you have any information or evidence as to what that goal should be for high school students? Should it be 100% that our goal should be to go to a four-year college? Should it be 75% or 50%? And then in that number, where does the technical side of that group of students lie? It seems to me that we have failed not just in the college end of it, and especially with the minority students, but I think we've failed miserably in the high school preparation for the technical end of it. Those students who want to be technicians, and I realize that they have to be highly trained nowadays, but I sometimes think we kind of pre-program a number of students to fail automatically when they go to college, and they don't, you know, they fall out that first year or that second year because that's not for them.
But Mr. Caperton.
This is, I've got to give you a point of view. I mean, I don't have facts to do. First of all, these figures about how many people complete AP programs in Florida and all the comparable states, they have other programs like IB, like you do here in Minnesota. So I don't think that those figures are very much out of line, because all states have sort of those kinds of similar kinds of programs with that kind of participation in it. I think that that you brought up a very important question, and I think that the real tragedy is in this country is that we have many students who are capable of doing college level work that are not preparing themselves in high school to do that, and there's multiple reasons for that. But this country and this state and my state are not going to be able to succeed in the future unless we do that. Because the jobs, you just look around at the jobs that you have today. Look what it's like to fix a truck today. There's no really, going to a modern factory that's world competitive today and see what people are doing. They all got a computer beside them and the equipment they're using. So I think that if we're not realistic about having to substantially improve everybody's educational level, those who are going to not go to college have got to have, you can't even get into the Army hardly today if you don't have a high school education. So we've really got to improve overall that whole, the graduation rate, the preparation quality of students, or this country is not going to be competitive in the future.
Mr. Caperton, when you talk about college, are you talking about post-secondary education, basically? I mean, it could be a two-year, it could be a one-year certificate program, it could be a four-year degree.
We've spent the last 2 years doing a report on community colleges, which I'll be happy to share with your committee. That'll come out in about 2 weeks. I think community colleges are one of the most important parts of our education system, and it's part of our education system that people from all around the world come to, because that's one of the places that we pick up a lot of students that maybe don't do so well in high school, go out and get a job, and then realize what the market's like and want to come back to college. It serves a wide market. Wide market of students in a remarkable way, in a very important part of our education system. So when I talk about post high school education, I certainly include community colleges.
A question from Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a retired math teacher, and I represent Egan, and I've seen AP courses up close because both my sons took them, and we had kids in our basement studying all the time, especially come test time. And I talked to kids and said, you know, I could take this course, this AP history, for example, and get a B, but I could take the normal course and get an A. And so why should I do all the work? Because a lot of them don't want to do that much work. And I think AP should be the norm, not just a high bar. And for example, a former student of mine went to the University of Minnesota just a couple of years ago, and she took I think it was an English Lit or English Writing course, and the professor there was a mix. There were some people that were majoring in English or English Writing or English Lit, can't remember for sure, and some were just like her, just take it because it was elective, but she was in an honors class. And she said the professor told them, I can tell who the AP students are because their writing is superior to even the majors in this course, you know, the upperclassmen. Their research techniques are superior. Everything about them, all their work is superior because, and every time I look closer, they're AP students. That's what this student told me. So I think there's extreme value to the AP courses. But you know, not everybody wants to go to college. Some people want to work with their hands and they learn specific trades, and I agree with you, the community colleges are extremely important. But I just wonder what your thoughts are regarding, I guess I'd like to see everybody take AP, but 100% is probably not going to happen.
Mr. Caperton.
Well, you know, I don't, you know, with a math teacher, I think you probably know much more about some of these things than I do. But, you know, I don't think I'll give you an interesting example that maybe says backs up what you're saying. I was at Arizona State University visiting that campus recently. It's a very progressive school run by a brilliant man. And he has two engineering courses he's teaching. One is he's teaching it, you learn as you do, and it doesn't have the same kind of courses in it. It has many students in there that didn't necessarily do well in high school and didn't have the physics course or the calculus course, but they're learning engineering by doing. So there's a lot of people that learn by doing, and it's sort of the old apprenticeship kind of way of learning. I think we've got to do every way to teach kids any way we can, but they do have to have today in this society a whole lot more skills than they did in my generation to be in the middle class, to be able to have a good income where they can educate their own children and live a decent life. So I think it's pretty hard today to not get a good education and have much of a life.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Governor, I am Sandra Erickson, a state representative from rural Minnesota, but I'm the Republican lead in education for our caucus. And looking at the report that you've given us, it really looks like local control. It's the colleges and universities, it's the schools and the school districts that set the expectations and sign the pledge. So tell us, what is the role of policymakers and fiscal agents such as ourselves in pursuing this?
Good question.
You're talking about the college key. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that for somebody like you, I would hope that there's some information in here because it was done from input from a lot of people across the country. I hope there's some information here that would be helpful to you as you study this issue. That there would be information that would help you if you talk to people and constituents about what I think is a critical issue. And I think you're an influential group that can talk to the colleges and universities that you are interested in and know, and say we think this is important stuff for you to participate in.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. Governor, we have a P16 group,
yes,
which you probably know about. And Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, we might want to pursue this at that next P16 meeting and just make sure that the group, including Dr. Brunix, is well aware of this, even though the university is autonomous. You know, we can do our talking then.
There was a representative from the university who attended the College Board Conference in last fall, and we are having a meeting after this with people from the P16 group with Governor Caperton. So, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Governor, welcome to our warm state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
A number of us are feeling a little warm right now because the temperature has gone up too much.
It's
a pleasure to have you here, Governor, on an issue that I think is vitally important, and I totally agree with the assessment that equity and excellence are should be always uttered in the same breath. You really, in our society, really can't have one without the other. As we obviously continue to diversify as a people, you know, issues of excellence are about racial and cross-cultural diversity, and you can bet that within those communities, they very much want excellence to be part of their education. So thank you for being a national voice on that. Representative Erickson is my lead in my committee, and as usual, she asks all the questions that I want to ask because she's just so good. But I will try nonetheless to add a little dimension to it. I want to also add on a little bit to Senator Stump's questions earlier about the different efforts that do happen in this state. We do have a richness of things that are occurring here. And not only within government, but also within the nonprofit sector. I'm involved with the creation of something called the Minnesota College Access Network, for instance, which borrows heavily from other college access network ideas that exist around the nation that focus particularly on the early awareness component of college, of moving into college among underrepresented groups. But so given that we have all those things that are happening, and you're aware we do have a P16 council as well, the question that I had is kind of a broader question, but it's similar to Representative Erickson's. In terms of this call to action, what do you see would be the sort of the value-added suggestions that you bring to our state, given the fact that we have a number of things happening in sometimes coordinated and sometimes not coordinated ways. So, for instance, should the legislature, in your mind, develop a long-term focus specifically on this issue, and should we perhaps develop policy measurements within by which we would hold our institutions accountable to those measures? And, of course, that begs in the bigger question of, and I think you mentioned it earlier, setting goals for our state. And I think it is kind of a maddening thing that I don't think I could tell you what our goals in our state are in regards to this, because I don't think we set them. Who sets that? Should we have our institutions set that? Should we have a school district set those goals? Should the legislature set those goals? Is that an agenda topic for the P16 table, for instance? So I just kind of want you to push us in terms of how do we take what's currently on the ground here in Minnesota, how do we take your call to increasingly focus on the system, but how do we translate that into some accountable system of goal setting and measuring and holding one another accountable for that? And perhaps where else in the nation have you seen movement in that direction?
Mr. Caperton.
Well, first of all, I mean, it would be arrogant for me to think that I could tell you all what's best for your wonderful state. I do think I can tell you what I think is a national problem. And I think it's a state problem and a national problem. You could cure a lot of the problems you have in a couple of years by legislation that you pass. But education, more than anything else, is a 25-year. If you do it today, it's 25 years before you see what the real results are or the big improvements that you make. We have 50,000. We've got 50,000 students. Low-income students in what we call college board schools that were funded by foundations where we go in and those schools and start those schools from scratch. And we've been doing that now for 3.5 years. We get these kids either in the sixth grade. We have one program that's from 6 to 12 and the other from 9 to 12. So if you take the ones that we're doing from the sixth grade up, we got to take kids that have had 6 years of a pretty lousy education. And then when we do them from 9 to 12, we get them down to 9th grade. So it's really hard for us because we got to do a lot of backpacking to get it back up to where they are. So it becomes very clear to you that it has to be a continuum of programs that probably start with prenatal care and go all the way through the system. So the system has to have, you have to have an overall look at the whole system, as you do with your system of that we're meeting with later on today. But the problem is trying to figure out how you can set very clear metrics about how you're going to measure your progress. Now, most of the people that are making these, that are voting for these, for appropriations, that people that have your responsibility, whether it's in the United States Congress or around the states, you know, or governors, they're in office 2, 4, 8. You know, their terms are usually relatively short in relationship to the problem, and so you kind of go in and try to do your best in the period of time you then serve. But it doesn't. There isn't a long term view or the long term commitment with the metrics that go along that line to be sure that you get it. So I think that's one of the real problems that we have in this country. And it's, you know, most countries have a national education program. Now, I'll give you a good example. We created AP Chinese because Americans don't know how to speak foreign languages. And we got to learn how to speak foreign languages. Everybody else speaks 2 or 3 languages. And we speak one language. So we got to do this. One of the great problems we've had in this Iraqi war, we didn't anybody speak the language, you know, what was going on with people we were over there with. So we create AP Chinese. It's clear that we need to learn how to speak Chinese. It's going to be our biggest trading partner and probably our biggest competitor. So we work with the Chinese government. We now have 100 Chinese teachers from China that are over here teaching in our American schools, teaching Chinese. When I was meeting with the woman that heads that up in China, she said to me, you know, in China now, every kid starts learning English in the 3rd grade, all across China, and said, why don't you all do that in the United States?
really? I read some Mindy Greiling, and I agree.
Yeah. And so,
we don't have a communist government, of course.
But basically, I'm not. I don't want you to get me wrong. But that gives them a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
That gives them a competitive advantage that there's national education policy. Now, I don't want to change the way we do things, but I think we have to be smarter and recognize some of the drawbacks about ways we do it and try to figure out how to do it better.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
And Governor, and you are a guest, and it's always kind of impolite to press guests, but I'm going to press you nonetheless.
I'm kind of
used to it. I figured you were. In terms of goal setting, though, kind of put the politics aside and for a second, but should legislative bodies set numerical, measurable goals in regards to increasing the numbers of our homegrown talent acquiring post-secondary degrees, and should we develop strong accountability measures to hold ourselves accountable for that?
Well, you know, I think the reason that you all have formed this P16 is to have an overall view of what education will be in, and I think that it's that kind of group that should create long-term goals with measurements, and then as a legislative body, you have to decide what laws you create and the funding that you give in order to meet those long-term goals. But I think that you're in the right track to have a policy group that's widely represented, and then that your job is once you look at that, is to what kind of laws and what kind of budgeting do you do in order to do that. But I think you should be held accountable about what that have measurements by which people are held accountable.
I have 4 other people in line who'd like to ask questions, and we do have 3 other presentations that are kind of local projects that are a follow-up of Mr. Caperton's comments and the College Board proposals. So with that, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Caperton, I'm
two questions. We've been dealing with the issue of rigor, and certainly there's no question that AP is a valuable tool. The first part of my question has to do with something you've touched on in a couple different ways, I think, which has to do with many school districts, my own and others that I'm aware of, have been working very hard to address the issue of low-income and minority students' lack of representation in AP classes. But in order to increase that, simply putting students in a class they're not prepared for is not adequate. And so you addressed briefly a springboard option. So I guess I would look to maybe a little broader, if you could address a little more broadly on how we prepare our students for AP rather than just forcing more students into a class unprepared. And then the second part is, in addition, we've been dealing with the issue of rigor. AP class enrollment certainly is one measurement, but have you looked at schools who may not be able to offer AP, and I think of some of our rural communities who may not have a class large enough, or successes of students who choose not to take AP, and as with Representative Morrow, several of my children have and several of them haven't. Are there students, and I hate to put your program on the spot, that can be successful without using AP enrollment as a measure? And I guess what I was looking at for our committee, are there students who go to a very rigorous high school, or can we make high schools that are very rigorous that are not AP or IB and expect them to be successful in college?
Representative Norton, our next presentation is about that kind of support group that provides support for low-income students to take rigorous courses, but certainly I'd like Mr. Caperton to respond to your entire question.
You know, I was certainly not an AP student. I was really happy when I graduated from high school. And so luckily I was in a real rigorous school, and what happened to me in that school was I had an English teacher in the 11th grade that taught me Shakespeare, taught me T.S. Eliot, taught me Faulkner. And I fell in love with learning in the 11th grade. And I've been a great learner ever since. So, you know, it is about learning. It is about falling in love with learning in schools. And not everybody has to take an AP course to fall in love with learning. But one thing you do know, one of the sad things that you have if you see children coming to colleges who have gotten A's in their courses and think they've taken rigorous work and come in there and leave after the first year because they were not prepared to do rigorous work, and not because they didn't know they were doing it. And so what you do know with an AP course is that it is rigorous, and you know it's national standards. And it really makes the AP teacher, because they're teaching this curriculum, becomes an inspiring teacher. And we had over 1,000 of your teachers in AP courses this summer. So you know the course is an interesting and calls on a student to do things that a less rigorous course does not. So the more AP courses you can have in a school, the more rigorous the school comes, and the better the teaching is. Because remember that AP Calculus teacher is also teaching an Algebra 1 and an Algebra 2 course. So it really does bring up, most of the superintendents that I know that are the best recognize the value of really focusing on bringing in AP into the school as a sign of rigor and as a way of training teachers and bringing up the whole caliber of the school. So, I think that a kid that doesn't take AP courses is not going to be president of the United States. Absolutely, I don't think that. But I shouldn't have said that.
I think you meant you knew that.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here. As a parent of a high school senior taking 4 AP classes, wow, I'm well invested in your program. But I do have some questions. We have a lot of work being done in Minnesota regarding STEM and driving our children into these areas. However, my own experience in being around high school students for the past 8 years, I have this sense that sometimes schools are pushing AP because it is the measure of which you can get on to the Newsweek top 100 schools.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask, what sort of data is there is with the additional rigor? Are we driving these kids into these areas? Because, again, from my personal experience, which you have to, I'll bring to the table with you, and sometimes these kids are so burnt out and so tired, and it's more of a book learning than a relevance and engaging them and catching them, that maybe we may have rigor, but is it really what we need in terms of our workforce? And I was at a presentation last week at St. Thomas with women engineers, and I kind of asked, is AP the way we're going to drive kids into engineering? There was great concern that we need to have more engagement to get their interest, and we may not be able to do that with AP the way it is structured right now.
Mr. Caperton.
Well, I hope that the person that said that will come up with a way to do it better. And there's lots of ways to learn. And I have a 15-year-old, and I know what it is. She's a good student, and sometimes I think she puts too much pressure on herself. But as a parent, you have to make those judgments, and children are different. So I certainly can't answer that question in a general way. If anybody can find better ways to teach children, prepare them in the STEM levels other than AP, then I'd say good for them. I'd like to learn for it, and I'll tell everybody in the country about it. So it's not the only thing. Today it happens to be the best, and it's the best model. And you know that you're getting a high standard, and you know that's what that student's going to be able to do when they get to college. So it is the best that we have. We're changing our math and all our science courses. I don't know if you know this, but Exxon has given $150 million and created new programs to teach STEM AP courses in which they give bonuses to give students scholarships and give teachers who get a lot of students in those programs successfully. And I think it's five or six states have gotten that first cohort that are doing that. Something Minnesota should look at to see if you all would want to compete for those grants. But it's an interesting program. So to answer your question, I hope you'll find a better way and let me know about it.
We have time for two more questions. Representative Mahoney and then Representative Dietrich.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Governor Caperton, I'm Representative Tim Mahoney, and I represent an inner city area, east side of St. Paul. My colleague, Representative Wardlow, mentioned that some kids aren't quite ready for AP because they like to work with the hands. I would take umbrage at that because actually I do work with my hands when I'm making an honest living. That's what my pipe fitter friends say. In any event, the first part about this is I work with engineers every day, and some from some of the most prestigious engineering schools in the nation, and there used to be a program where you didn't have to go through college to become an engineer. Same as with an accountant and a number of other professions. We had a half a dozen people trying to figure out how we could, in the bottom of one of these waste sewage tanks were very corrosive, couldn't figure out why all the metal was just falling apart and everything was falling over. And this, I can't remember what they used to call them, demonstrated engineers anyhow, after about 3 weeks of going through all these calculations and configurations on how to stop this corrosion, this fella came out and he looked at it and he says, rather than mild steel, why don't you use stainless steel? And fortunately for the pipe fitters, that was such a smart idea. We've got tons of staff hours putting in stainless steel in the bottom of sludge tanks for the last 10, 12 years. So sometimes, it's just the obvious. And AP doesn't always get you all the answers. My real question here, so you have to also be smart. to be a tradesperson or a, as you said, a mechanic on an automobile. I'm sitting on the higher ed committee, so I don't really quite understand on the K-12 some of the answers that I'm sure are on the tip of some people's tongues. What is the cost of making these particular type of classes the standard rather than the option? And I'm not sure that's a question you can answer, but maybe the chairs of the K-12 committees can answer.
Yeah, the cost is pretty minimal. You take it. You have the cost of the test. You pay the teacher the same. You have to train the teacher, which is a cost. But as a incremental cost about what it costs to improve a school because you put AP in it is a very incremental cost, very small cost.
Thank you. And Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it seems to me that the essence of AP, as I've been learning more about this, is teacher training. And so do you know of any models, or are you working on any models that have throughout the country that have AP teacher training right in the regular teacher degree college program? And if you would answer that, and then there's a second part to the question that for time's sake I'll ask right now. What have you done to make it easier to train more teachers?
The first question is, we don't do it in the education schools today. I think we should. We're studying how to do that, and it's something that we should be doing, but it's not done. And your second question is what? Maybe your second question again. I'm sorry.
What do you do in different states to give better access to AP training? If the goal is to have more children in AP classes, we have to train more teachers. How do we train more teachers in the masses?
For instance, in Florida, we had a whole program about increasing the number of teachers that were going to AP classes in the summer. So we built a whole program that was financed through the state to do that. So it was not a terribly big cost. So that's something that you can't expand your AP program without expanding the number of teachers you have, and that's one of the parts of the program. Yes.
Chairwoman Pappas, Representative
Dietrich. Ms. Brenner.
We actually work collaboratively with institutions of higher education and with local school districts or on a regional basis to try to offer professional development that's convenient and to build out that capacity. For example, the Advanced Placement Summer Institute model is actually based on a cooperative agreement with a post-secondary institution and K-12 working together to offer those types of programs. So we do try to recognize needs and expand programs as necessary, and as the state is moving forward with providing more opportunities, we would be looking to do additional work both on the ground, but we are also expanding our virtual professional development opportunities so that teachers don't have to leave their buildings, or if it's in this state, distance is an issue, that the teachers would actually be able to engage in the professional development online. And we are developing an entirely new online professional development model to help make professional development more accessible to all teachers.
Great. I don't think I specifically introduced Ms. Renner, but thank you again for your help in putting this together. Mr. Caperton, did you have any closing comments you wanted to make? Anything that you didn't get to mention?
First of all, thank you very much for your inviting me here. And any way we can work with you to help improve education in your state or any state is what our purpose in life is, and so we appreciate us having such an open and honest discussion, and best of luck to you and have a nice winter.
All right, thank you very much for coming in for the day. Next we'd like to invite Jim Nelson and Dr. Margaret Smith and thank them for coming from California to do a presentation for us about a program that they pioneered called AVID, Advancement Via Individual Determination, and I'm not sure if the PowerPoint is working or not. Did that get
Well, Senator Pappas, I think it does work, but I'm afraid it would take too much time.
Okay.
But I, in watching the dialogue with Governor Caperton, I think I would better...
And we have the slides anyway, right?
Oh, do you? Oh, no, I don't know whether you... No, I don't think you do. What I am going to do is make
sure...
Oh,
I thought we did.
Your staff... No. Okay. I will get it to your right. staff, where everyone that wants it can get it, but there's about 40 or so of them, and I'm just afraid it'll take too much of your time, and hope you don't mind.
Okay, thank you. Well, proceed and tell us about the program.
I'm kind of doing this on the fly. Hi, good morning. I'm Jim Nelson. I'm the executive director of Avid Center. We're based in San Diego. With me this morning is Dr. Barbara Smith, who is one of our vice presidents. She is involved with governmental relations and equity. We're, as you will see in some of the things we talk about, and we also have some Avid students here that I think you're going to see and be introduced to in a little while. We're very concerned about many of the issues that were raised in your conversation with Governor Caperton. It's an honor to be here. It was slightly warmer in San Diego when I left there yesterday morning. Although I will say it was supposed to storm all weekend, which hardly ever happens. I hate to be there, not to see it. You know, I've only lived in California about a year and a half now, and I think it's rained twice since I've been there. But and one time I was out of town, so I hope they video it so I can watch it. But it's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here. Let me give you just very briefly a little bit about my background. Maybe set in context how I got here. In 2004, the summer of 2004, I became the superintendent of a fairly large school district in the Dallas area, Richardson, Texas. It's a suburban-urban district of about 34,000 students. More than half of them live in the Dallas city limits. About two-thirds of them are non-white. 50% qualifies for free or reduced lunch. We had 93 languages spoken in the district, so they were, like a lot of metropolitan areas, they were from all over the world. It was a district that was relatively wealthy in terms of the Texas school districts. Texas Instruments was the major taxpayer in the district, although before I came they had no relationship with the district, which I found to be strikingly odd, but we fixed that pretty quickly. In that summer, I, for the first time, and before that, I had served as Commissioner of Education in Texas from 1999 to 2002, had been a school board member, and before that, practiced law for many years, and I'm a long recovering lawyer now. I don't even have to go to the meetings anymore. I got into the policy arena and into education, which has been a real pleasure. But, late in 2004, I became, aware of a program that we were doing in Richardson called Avid. I had never heard of it, was not the least bit familiar with it, and was taken by our district director for Avid, and we have two district directors from Minnesota. Scott and Darlene are here, two incredibly talented educators that are from the Minneapolis area, St. Paul area. But the person that held that position in my district took me to meet three young people who were going to present to the freshman center staff at one of our high schools about their previous year in Avid. And these were three young people from, one was an immigrant from Africa, one was a Hispanic young man who'd been in the country a few years, and the other one was an African-American boy that had been lived in Dallas all of his life. And all three of them lived in apartments, relatively poor families. None of their families had any college experience in their background, and these young people had been in Avid for 1 year, and they stood there and addressed these 120 or so faculty members and blew them away, had them in tears talking about their experience and how this program had changed their life. And so I looked at Eileen, our district director, and said, I don't know anything about this, but obviously it's had a significant impact on these three young people, and I'd like to know more. And she said, well, I'm glad you do, since he runs the program. And we're going to expand to 7 schools from the 3 we had. Our hope is to have it in all our secondary schools 2 years later. And we began talking about what the plans were and how it worked. What Avid does is takes young people that are in the academic middle, identified by the school, When I say the academic middle, it's typically the kid from the 25th percentile to the 75th percentile. Kids that wander through school, oftentimes taking only basic courses, oftentimes are they're typically not troublemakers. In fact, they create no waves at all, often. They just kind of wander through school. They're the kind of kid that will go to school for an entire week at one of your high schools and no adult ever speaks to them. And that happens every single week in your school, just like it does in schools all over the country. They just don't. They just kind of disappear into the woodwork. But these are kids whose potential is completely untapped, and whose potential needs to be tapped. This all began 28 years ago when an incredible English teacher in the San Diego school named Mary Catherine Swanson. The school was desegregated by a court order, and a bunch of kids were bussed in from the border. And instead of leaving the school like a lot of her peers did, she decided that I'm going to find a way to create something that will support these kids so they can be equally successful in my very high-level English class. And it wasn't about just putting them in there and either letting them sink or swim or dumbing down the curriculum. It was about how can I create an elective that will give them the kind of support that will allow them to be successful in AP English and AP Social Studies and AP Science and AP Mathematics and whatever else you might want to call high-level courses so that they truly could be ready to go to college. One of the great tragedies that you've talked about in this country is how many kids we have graduating from our high schools that are truly not college ready. We have a huge, you know, we have done a good job of increasing the college-going population, but we haven't done near as good a job of increasing the college-ready population. And I would also say that being college-ready doesn't mean you have to go to college. What it means is if you've got the skill set and the mental makeup and the ability, the study skills and the habits of mind and the work ethic, that you can be successful no matter what you do. Whether you go to a trade school, whether you go to a community college, whether you go into the military, or whether you go to the University of Minnesota. Those are the kinds of skills that we're trying to inculcate into these youngsters. Over the next 28 years, this program has grown to the point that we're now in 45 states, 15 foreign countries, 16 actually, from Canada, and we're in all the Department of Defense schools in Europe and Asia. We're in some 3,500 schools, and we're directly impacting about 300,000 students right now. I gave you some statistics as to what we are doing in Minnesota. It's growing quite rapidly. You know, Senator Pappas heard Dr. Smith present at the College Forum, back in October, and became interested in what we do. Let me give you a very quick summary, and then I'll let you ask questions, because there's far more. I mean, I could talk for an hour and still not cover all the bases, and so I hope you understand that I'm really just hitting the high points. How Avid starts in a school is with an elective. We focus on training, teacher training. The professional development side is probably the key component. When we enter into a contract with a school district such as St. Paul, they agree to send 8 people from each school to a summer institute that we host, and this summer we'll do 8 of them. The closest one to you will be in Chicago. Included in those 8 people will be the person that they choose or persons they choose to actually teach the elective. They will also send an administrator from the school. They will also send a counselor from the school. They will also send a teacher from each of the 4 core areas, and then they can pick the other person or persons that they want to come. While they're at that summer institute, they will spend 4.5 days. In the morning, they will work with job-alike people, and they will be trained by professionals who have been in Avid for a long time, who we contract with to lead these strands. So, for example, the elective teacher will spend the morning with other elective teachers focusing on how they do that particular role. The science teachers will be with other science teachers being led by an expert science teacher about how they can use Avid kinds of strategies to increase the performance of a wide array of students in their classroom and so on across the board. In the afternoon, they will then get back together with their teams from their school and from their school district, and they will plan for the coming year. As the school year starts, the elective is part of the school day in this state, I assume, and in most states has been approved as either an innovative course or as an elective that you get credit for. The week is typically broken up into 5 days. That makes sense. But the two of those days, they will actually utilize an AVID curriculum that we provide. It focuses on high-level writing, high-level reading, collaborative skills, inquiry, how to ask better questions, how to ask really high-level questions. Two of the days, they will work with tutors that have come from your local colleges, either the universities or the community college, who are trained in AVID tutorology, as we call it, and they work with groups of kids in subject matter groups, not to give them the answers, but to teach them, to help them learn how together arrive at the answers. So it's really working on higher order thinking skills. The other day, they will focus on study skills, classroom management kinds of skills. They have to keep a binder. They have to keep track of their stuff. One of the reasons I was so enamored with AVID to begin with, I have a now 26-year-old son who could never keep up with his stuff. And although we focus and we talk a lot about how we work mostly with kids that come from families that don't have a college-going experience, my wife has a master's degree, I have a law degree, we didn't have a clue how to help this kid. One of the reasons I got so quickly, you know, I thought this is, you know, this, where was this when Cliff was in high school? So when they leave our high schools, they know how to do school. That's sort of the hidden curriculum that we don't do a very good job with kids anywhere in this country, except in AVID, in terms of helping them understand what it takes to get through and organize your day and what's expected of you, and their homework is checked. I mean, especially if you begin at the 6th or 7th grade level, it's fairly basic, but it gets extremely high level by the time they're juniors and seniors, where they're doing Socratic seminars, philosophical chairs. They have the senior class is actually like a college class. They are required to take higher level courses. If they're in high school, they're required to take at least one AP course. If it's a middle school kid, they'll be required to take some kind of an honors course or something to get them into more rigor. One of the things that I didn't have time to get to because it's on the PowerPoint is to talk about what rigor really means and the kind of work that's going on out there in the country right now about college readiness. If you haven't seen the work of Dr. David Conley out of the University of Oregon, I would really urge you to see that. He's done some great work that's being used by a number of states in trying to, especially their T16 council, in terms of trying to determine what is the best way to make sure these young people are truly ready for college. What instructors at the college level will tell you is the writing skills in particular are grossly insufficient. Even kids that think they're doing fairly high-level writing as seniors find that the jump between the 12th grade and the 13th grade mm-hmm. is huge in terms of what writing is demanded of these young people. So, anyway, I'm kind of going off.
Mr. Nelson, I don't want to run out of time before we get a chance to hear from Dr. Smith. So.
You want to answer?
just add.
He's really the expert.
No. thanks, Madam Chair, and distinguished leaders that take forward education as an initiative. I looked at some of your legislation. Thanks to Jim and to Mary Catherine Swanson when I entered AVID, the world of AVID, to look at an AVID classroom, and I think you'll see it. To see it gives you a better picture than either of us can tell you about it. But just think about a group of students, and Jim mentioned between 25% to 75% of our student population in our schools are those students in the academic middle. And think of those students going in school every day and just taking classes, regular classes, not being challenged. So what we do is the concept of rigor and support. If we provide rigor and we do not provide support during the school day, then what happens at home? And then what happens the next day when they go to school? So these students and these great leaders What we train on in Abbott is, of course, like you're in the Abbott elective class, they're taught to organize the work, and they're taught to integrate instructional strategies, writing, so that's getting at needs of every student and every teacher, inquiry. It is not, I know, during my time in school, learning Bloom's and Costas in the sixth grade, that was unheard of. So students are able to know what a level one question, level two, level three, level four. And then they're engaging each other. You know, students like to talk. So in an Abbott class, there is high engagement. They're in round tables. It's not the traditional classroom setting. They're doing a lot of non-academic. Jim talked about the bind organization and also the training, that the high-quality training. But very seldom, there are certain things that are not targeted or taught and things that we take for granted. For instance, we tell an Abbott kid, a young lady or a young man, sit in the front of the classroom. Sit up straight. Yeah. Then, take notes. So we teach them corner note-taking. But we also teach that to the parents. We have a family interactive workshop. Because you cannot have those gaps dealing with all the gaps we already have. So in the corner note-taking, just think about, I'm writing, and we teach them how to take notes. The star system of note-taking, from setting up the page to writing the date to everything. So then, they take their notes, they leave spaces, and they have to be graded. What's inspected is respected, so they know. They start out as real sloppy, but they get better at it, and they understand it, and they can explain it to someone else, to their peers. So when they get home at night, during the first, let's say, September, they're writing basically level one questions. But as they move through the year, they're writing level two, level three, etc. So what happens here, the students now have a system. And so it's causing the students to stretch. The students have the notes. It's also going to cause the teachers to stretch as well. Because now they have their notes, they have their questions. When they get home at night, they have their reflective summary. So I don't care if it's art, PE, English, math, science, social studies. At the end of the day, they're going to write their summary. So now I own this work for every class. So that's from 6th through 12th grade. So that's just part of what happens in the Abbott class. And during the tutorials, they have to have their questions ready before they walk in the class. So what you see here, we're training students to be responsible for their work. And we're honoring the dignity of all learners. And also, as students then move from year to year, there is some sequencing, and we have staff at Abbott that's constantly working on the sequencing of instruction. But we get a lot of our information from the field. As we have our Abbott teachers and coordinators, for instance, at the district office, there is an Abbott district director, like Dr. Darlene Fry, here in Minnesota. Those district directors need support. They need support from the superintendent, and they need support from their peers, and also from Abbott Center. Then that's our job, to make sure that we provide 2 years of training for the district directors. So now you're building capacity at the school site. So those individuals, I mean, you're not having, we do send Abbott consultants and other people in. However, over time, you've built the capacity, and so you have the wealth of the strategies and the research-based strategies and the curriculum all in one school community. And so the goal is, even though we're starting with those students, just targeting for the elective class, those students in the academic middle, over time, whether a teacher or administrator has or has not attended an Abbott Institute, those strategies would be in the English course, English, math, science, social studies, PE, etc. There's a note taken in all of those. So basically, that gives you what it is, and I think the students and the coordinators will talk more about, you know, how Abbott works from a practical. We talk about theory and practice, how it works in their schools, It is not the panacea. However, if we get the right district director, someone with a passion, someone that does not mind working hard to get what all of our students deserve and doesn't mind moving around about the school community. If you have someone that's not communicating up to the district office, to the superintendent, and also throughout that school community, to the parents, connecting with the colleges and universities, now there are benefits there. Those college students that have not been trained, the how-tos of learning, the how-tos of studying, we hear from them, they benefit greatly from this. So Avid is not, we call it an underserved, it's a collaborative support system for underserved students. However, it's a collaborative support system for all of us. And now I'll stop for questions.
Thank you very much, both of you, Mr. Nelson and Dr. Smith. I'm going to change the agenda around a little bit because I want to hear from the students and the instructors who actually have an AVID program. I know Representative Erdahl had a quick question, and then I'm going to ask Ms. Olhoff and Mr. Thomas and the three students to come and join us and do your presentation next. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering, is this a State Department initiative? How schools become involved in this? Do they request? Are they recruited? I notice you have 9 school districts listed. 8 of them are relatively, well, I would consider to be very large school districts. 1 of them is a very small school district, Howard Lake, which is mine. Yeah. And that's why I'm interested in how they are chosen.
Well, they really choose us. We're organized as a nonprofit under California law, so we're eligible for grants and a lot of schools use a variety of sources to pay for the program. But we don't have a sales force per se. We've now broken the country into divisions, and you're part of the central division. I think the program has grown more by word of mouth almost than anything else, to be quite honest. But it's kind of started to build on top of itself now to a considerable degree because it's successful in one place or we present somewhere. And Senator Pappas, for example, met Barbara in New York. But it's really mushroomed in the last 3 or 4 years as a result of that. And there's been, we're in, obviously California is our largest size. We have nearly half the sites are there, but Texas and Florida and North Carolina, Chicago, there's just a wide array of places that we've grown pretty dramatically. And we've seen, you can see, even though the numbers are not great, it's grown significantly in Minnesota just in 1 year. A lot of that, Darlene and Scott, have a lot to do with that because they're such good, great missionaries.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And this is a great presentation. Thank you for being here. I wanted to ask either of you to comment on the results, the outcomes, how you're measuring success here. I see on your hand, the one handout we have, and I know you put in your PowerPoint, the added students, 100% of them are on track for acceptance to a four-year university. But how do you specifically measure that your program is making a difference?
Well, we do it in a number of different ways. In fact, data is very, very important to me. And so if anything, we've enhanced it in the year and a half I've been there. But each school is required to go through a certification process each year after they've been in the program for a year. So they have to provide us a great deal of information about how these kids are doing. But we also have what we call a senior report. Now, you don't yet have any seniors. I think the first graduating seniors are in 2009. This year, 2008. Okay, well, that information is incorrect that I gave you. We ask each senior to fill out an online survey as to how many colleges they've applied to, where they've applied to, whether they've been accepted, and all of that kind of thing. And so we have some information that shows that 98% of this last year's seniors nationwide, it's about 12,000 kids, were accepted either at a four-year or at a two-year and plan to attend a school of higher education. One of the things we're trying to get better at, and it's very difficult, is to follow those kids once they get into college. We have some old studies. We're involved right now in Canada, of all places, in British Columbia, in a government-sponsored foundation program where they're actually, the kids are signing a contract to give us information for 6 years. Where they started as seventh graders, and it'll run through the time they're, eighth graders, and it'll run through their sophomore year in college. So we'll have a lot better information. We know that these kids are all going to college and that they're doing well. We just don't have as strong a data to support that as I would like. But what we do know, we're doing some research now on how they're doing on state exit exams versus non-avid kids. Just a wide array of different ways. I can tell you, in Texas, they've collected data differently, more data from avid kids than they have in other states. And what we've seen is their state assessment scores are higher than their peers across the board.
Mr. Nelson, do you have that information on your website, for example?
I believe so, yes, and I can get you all the data. There's a little bit on the PowerPoint, but not in huge detail.
Well, maybe we could get a copy of your PowerPoint, and then we could provide that to members.
Yes,
Dr. Smith.
Yes, and we have we've had some independent researchers earlier. And I remember a question earlier about the remediation in college. And as they did a 10-year study of avid students, at the end of the freshman year, we had an 89% retention rate. And that was done by Hugh Meehan and a group of researchers in Texas. And then we've had Grace Guthrie and Larry Guthrie doing some studies. So all of that we can include with that data, so we have really a mixture of a lot of research.
And I believe there is some documentation of the research in the College Peace Compact book.
We've had a long and very happy collaborative with the College Board, by the way. I mean, they have such a focus on equity and access now, and one of the things we're able to help them do is get more diversity into AP classes.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you touched on, my follow-up question was going to be how would those numbers compare with a similar group of students that aren't in the program, and it sounds like you have some of that data, and maybe I can just do that. We can't know this.
The Canada study actually has a control group of kids that were selected for AVID and then deselected. Which I thought was, I'm not sure you can do that in America.
Okay, I'd like to bring up the Apple Valley folks then for the remainder of the time. And I think we're probably going to have to ask Ms. Dorsbeck to come and present another time. But there is a handout about the rigorous courses that we are offering in Minnesota in your packet or at your place that she was going to talk about for a few minutes. So be sure you know that we do have a full a wide variety of college prep programs and support programs and get ready programs. Yeah. I know, we have to get out of here at 12. Yeah, I know. Okay, welcome, and why don't you introduce yourselves, and we have about 20 minutes for you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Lori Olhoff.
Can you pull the microphone a little closer, Lori, can hear you?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Lori Olhoff. I live in Farmington, Minnesota, and I'm here to represent District 196, that is Rosemont, Apple Valley, and Eagan, Minnesota. I'm here to talk about our pre-AP, AP, and AVID program, which we have combined all these efforts in our district. I'm the one who has the PowerPoint in your handout packet, so you do have a handout of our presentation. In the packet, or handout, it talks about the size of our district to just kind of give you some perspective of our district. We're the fourth largest district in the state of Minnesota. We have 18 elementaries, 6 middle schools. We have pre-AP in all of our middle schools. We're doing pre-AP in middle school science right now. And that means about 6,800 middle school students are experiencing pre-AP science. We have 4 comprehensive high schools. AVID is at our Apple Valley High School. At our middle school level, AVID is at our Valley Middle School. At the elementary and middle school, we have AVID Student Success Path program. It's a 5th and 6th grade program that is a precursor to the AVID elective that starts in 7th grade. We have 3 magnet schools and 1 theme-based high school. Advanced placement in our district starts with the pre-AP strategies that are introduced to all of our students in our middle school science courses. In the high school level, our students are introduced to honors courses. They have the first opportunity to take advanced classes in advanced science in middle school and advanced and honors classes in high school. Our AP courses become available to students as early as 10th grade. My position in the district is the integration enrichment coordinator. And our department in the district is passionate about equity and access for all students. Our district was looking for initiatives that would hold the greatest promise for all students, giving them access to high-level coursework, rigorous coursework, and that would increase achievement for all students, which led us to the College Board and the Pre-AP program. When we were researching the program, what excited us about it was that it was for all students, not just for a few students. Pre-AP is not a course for a few students. It's for all students. Yeah. And our science teachers were trained, all 40 science teachers were trained by a College Board trainer in 2006. It was a two-day training. We received a grant from the state of Minnesota for the initial training. We added a third day to this initial training for us to sit back and ask the science teachers to say, okay, you've had the training, you know what the program is now, how do we make this work for District 196? What do we need to do as a district to make this program work here? The teachers created what we call the Science Initiative, and they wrote a two-year plan for how to implement Pre-AP across the district. We looked at the lesson study. It's a study of how to do rewrite curriculum, starting from the ground up, looking at essential learning and working through all of that. In other words, we have a long-term commitment to implementing Pre-AP across the curriculum. What I wanted to really to impact on these few slides here is that what Pre-AP did for us is it allowed us to have a dialogue, a vertical dialogue with our high school teachers as well, to look at the essential learning and skills. I wanted to tie into what was said earlier by the College Board, that the College Board connects us to those national standards for excellence. And it helped us know what those standards are and bring them all the way through down to sixth grade. And so through that dialogue with our high school teachers, our middle school teachers are now aligning those strategies that they're learning about, and they're able to say, what are we doing in our labs, our science labs, and how is the language and everything that we're doing in those labs connecting to what you're expecting high school students to do, to all the way through. So every student starting in sixth grade is learning those same things. So this has been we're now in our second year, so it's a long-term journey for us. I wanted to talk a little bit about what it looks like in the classroom. There's five basic steps. Engagement is the first one. And for our science teachers, this was a big change for us. We usually, the science teachers would tell you that they started their lessons with explain. They told all the students everything they needed to know about the topic, all the language and all the verbiage, all the important people about the science, and pretty much put the students to sleep before they started the lesson. And then they tried to re-engage them. Mm-hmm. And what the College Board strategies were taught them was that you needed to engage the students first, then you get them to explore, and then you explain, and get the students to explain too, and help elaborate from there. So the five strategies really work well with scientific inquiry-based lessons. The impact of the Pre-AP strategies on teaching and learning it created a collegial support network for our teachers. We met last year for 9 months straight. Every month, the science teachers worked in their school for 1 month, creating a portion of their lesson, and the next month they shared that portion with the rest of their, like the sixth grade team. And then the next month they'd work on another portion of the lesson, and then they'd share it again with the rest of the sixth grade team. So every month, the science departments were working on science, and it created, again, that vertical alignment and that curriculum discussion. what we saw in the students is that the classroom standards increased. It enriched the learning environment. It created equity and opportunity for all the students. One of the things the classroom teachers told us within the first month of using the PREAT strategies is that they had to increase the rigor across the curriculum. It was the first. they never expected that. Another result that we experienced is that after just six months of doing pre-AT, 14% increase of in enrollment in our honors classes for the following year in honors classes, which translated to more sections of ninth grade honors or science across the district. So while the other thing that was really important for us to realize is that while we were increasing access for all the students, we were also raising the bar. At the honors course in the high school level,
Ms. Ohoff, I think it might be, if you don't mind, I think the committee members would really like to hear from the students about what they experienced and how it helped them to either participate in AVID or to be exposed to pre-AP. I'm sure we're going to run out of time before we get to the students.
The AVID, these students didn't experience AVID or pre-AP because it started after they were in the middle school. If you want to talk a little bit about your AVID experience, I'll just put
this on. We also have students from St. Paul. So you'll hear from 2 10th grade students and 2 seniors who have had either 2 years of AVID experience or 3 years of AVID experience. We want to give our time.
Okay, if you could just introduce yourself and give us a little idea on how you what you gained from the program.
Hi, my name is Magali Ortiz, and I'm in 10th grade AVID at Apple Valley High School. Before I was in AVID, I knew I wanted to go to college, but I didn't know exactly what steps to take or what classes were required of me to take. I didn't even know how the colleges looked like. But by being in AVID, I've learned so much. Now I know by taking the field trips with AVID that how the colleges look like, that there are private colleges and community colleges. Also, I've learned what the colleges expect from a student, like a high GPA or that you take honors or AP classes and language classes. Also that you do community service. I think that AVID has also helped me a lot with my organization skills, because before I was in AVID, I used to misplace things a lot, which would bring my grades down. But now with the binder, I believe that I know where my homework is, where my notes are, and I can keep my grade up that way. I also think that the CSGs, or the Collaborative Study Group, have helped me a lot, because if I am confused before like a test, or if I don't understand something in a class, I know that I can take a question to my Collaborative Study Group and that we will discuss it, and that each of us, my classmates that have similar classes to me, will help me understand what I need to understand. And I think that by this being my second year in AVID, it has helped me to be a better person and a better student too, and that I don't see AVID as a class anymore, but more like of a helping hand. And I see it kind of like a family, because at the beginning it has its hard times, it's hard to get used to, but at the end it wants the best for you, and it wants you to achieve your goals, and I know that AVID will help me achieve my dream of going to college.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ortiz. Appreciate it. Spoke very eloquently.
Good morning, Minnesota State Legislature. I'm Marcus Jones, and I live in Apple Valley. I currently attend Apple Valley High School. I don't really know how to tell you all about, like, AVID. It has really helped me in my school learning. I guess to start this off, I must tell you about my school career before this program came into existence. I attended Falconridge Middle School, where on average I would get C's and B-minuses mostly. I was taking no honors courses or accelerated courses either. Once I found out about the Advanced Via Individual Determination Program, AVID, I knew I wanted to join immediately. I was welcomed with great care, and I was ushered into a great learning experience once I was accepted. I come from a middle-class background. I have 6 older siblings who have gone to college also. I believe AVID isn't for one type of person, and I believe that it's for all students, and it could help everyone. Since entering the course, my grades have increased with better test scores and good marks on report cards. I'm now taking advanced placement in history, getting a B in it, and last year I took civics and honors English. In AVID, my self-confidence and social skills have also improved drastically since making some great new friends. AVID has really helped me more than grades can go. I do plan on going to college as well. We as the AVID class have gotten to tour 2 colleges, including the U of M and St. Thomas Academy. This has really helped me to broaden my horizon. The most beneficial thing to my education is the CSG, Collaborative Study Groups. I would have to say, in these tutorials, I can ask questions and that are difficult for me in classes. And I really learn to be independent and to kind of learn on my own. And, yeah, it really helps me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. Great statement. Next.
Hi, my name is Penny Mayer from Elgin High School in St. Paul here. I started at about 3 years ago, and now it's my 3rd year. I'm a senior. And I'm currently graduating from Arlington High School. I'm possibly attending the U of M Twin City here. And from AVID, it took us on our campus visits. So I've been to St. Kate's with AVID and also been to UMD and the U of M Twin City here. And after I attend AVID my sophomore year in high school, I enrolled in AP English and AP History. And then currently my senior year, I'm in college and school. And also I'm a PhD student at Concordia State University in St. Paul here. And then through taking those classes, it's pretty difficult, but AVID helped me through tutorials time where we state level 3 questions, where our peers helped us finish or find answers to questions that we need help to. And AVID is, I think the best thing about AVID is the binder of organizations. And within the binder, they have different sheets for keeping track of our grades or just assignment and stuff. And then through that, the organizations helped me prepare better for college, because I guess in college, in order to like complete work, and through my experience at Concordia, I had read a lot of college essays, and you go through a lot of research and stuff, and without organization things there for you to set, it's impossible to collect all the data as well, while there's so many things to collect to write a paper. I did research paper, and without my AVID folder, just keeping track of things that I had, I wasn't able to write papers and stuff. So I guess organizations are the biggest help to AVID that I find.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Fang. Another student?
Hello, my name is Katori Morgan, and I'm...
Can you say your name again?
Katori Morgan.
Morgan?
Mm-hmm. I'm a senior at St. Paul Central High School, and I've been at AVID for 3 years. I think that AVID kind of took me from just resting in my studies to actually, like, being really engaged and concerned with my education. And now, instead of just sitting in class and just watching the clock, waiting for it to be over, now I'm wondering, like, okay, are we going to have enough time to get through everything that we're supposed to learn today? And so I think that I would have gone to college if I wasn't in AVID, but I don't think I would be as excited as I am right now. Like, I'm so ready to go to college. And I don't know, I want to compare it to the high school experience, because my high school experience has been, it's been good, but I think that college is just going to take me to the next level. The people I'm in my other class with are, like, the greatest people in the world. And it's like I can have a bad day, like, the whole day, but once I get an AVID, that's all gone. Because they're going through the same things that I'm going through, and they're so comfortable, and they offer the same world for education as I do. This is the famous AVID binder.
Oh, we want to see that. Whoa, that's impressive.
And it's actually a little smaller than it usually is right now. The point of it is to have all your classes in there so that there's not the potential of, like, losing anything. Like, the spiral notebook, you tend to keep them separate and you lose them. But if I lost this, then I'd lose my whole day. It's so big and so heavy that I can't read it. So I think it's just
I think there's a lot of details that sometimes become frustrating, but compared to 10th grade when I first got to now, I'm actually thankful for all the times my teacher told me to do Cornell notes, and all the times where I had to write down all my homework and make sure it was all done, because I'm a lot more organized than I used to be, and now it's a lot harder for me to forget something than it used to be, because I used to come to class the next day like, we had homework? I didn't hear that, but it makes me a lot more alert now, and so I'm really excited to go to college.
Where are you looking at going to college?
I really want to go to USC or Spelman in Atlanta.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Morgan.
Go Central.
Yeah.
Oh. But so far I've been accepting to DeSavis and Hamlin.
Okay.
So I might stay here.
You might stay home. Yeah. Both great colleges. And I think we didn't introduce Mr. Is that Mr. Thomas?
Yes, that's Scott Thomas. Scott Thomas.
And also? Okay. Great, Dr. Fry, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Thomas and Ms. Olhoff, for all your hard work. Do any members have any questions for the students or any of the instructors? Well, thank you all again, once again, for joining me today and Representative Rukavina, and we hope to be working on these issues together. And thank you all in the audience for coming. The meeting is adjourned.